Chapter 7. A Cold Medallion. Shonchen soldiers. Blood and bloody ashes. That was all Matt needed, with the dice spinning his head. No, find Aginen and Warner. Ulver, you won the Aes Sedai. And Bethemon and Seta. Those five would all be together, or at least close by one another. The two former Suldam shadowed the sisters whenever they left the wagon they all shared. Lighty hoped none of them had gone into the town again. That could put a weasel in the chicken yard for sure. I'll go down to the entrance and try to see if we're in any trouble.
She won't answer to that name,
Noel muttered, sliding out from the table. He moved spryly for a fellow who looked to have half the bones in his body broken one time or another.
You know she won't.
You know who I mean, Matt told him sharply, frowning at Tuon and Seleucia. This name foolishness was their fault. Seleucia had told Aginen that her name was now Lylwyn Shipless, and that was the name Aginen was using. Well, he was not about to put up with that sort of thing, not for himself and not for her. She had to come to her senses, soon or late.
I'm just saying, Noel said. Come on, Ulver.
Matt slid off after them, but before he reached the door, Tuon spoke.
No warnings for us to remain inside, Toy? No one left to guard us?
The dice said he should find Harnin or one of the other Red Arms and plant him outside just to guard against accidents, but he did not hesitate. You gave your word, he said, settling his hat on his head. The smile he got in reply was worth the risk. Burn him, but it lit up her face. Women were always a gamble, but sometimes a smile could be win enough. He saw from the entrance that Jurador's days without a Shonchan presence had come to an end. Directly across the road from the show, 700 men were taking off armor, unloading wagons, setting up tents in ordered rows, establishing horse lines. All very efficiently done. He saw Terrabanners with mail veils hanging from their helmets and bars of blue, yellow, and green painted across their breastplates, and men who were clearly infantry, stacking long pikes and racking bows, much shorter than a Two Rivers bow, in armor painted the same. He thought those must be Amadisians. Neither Terrabon nor Altara ran much to foot, and Altarans in service to the Shonchan had their armor marked differently for some reason. There were actual Shonchan, of course, perhaps 20 or 30 that he could see. There was no mistaking that painted armor of overlapping plates or those strange insectile helmets. Three of the soldiers came ambling across the road, lean, hard-bitten men. Their blue coats, with the collars striped green and yellow, were plain enough despite the colors, and showed the wear of armor use, but no signs of rank. Not officers, then, but still maybe as dangerous as red adders. Two of the fellows could have been from Andor or Murindi or even the Two Rivers, but the third had eyes tilted like a Saldaean's, and his skin was the color of honey. Without slowing, they started into the show. One of the horse handlers at the entrance gave a shrill, three-note whistle that began to echo through the show, while the other, a squint-eyed fellow named Bolin, pushed the glass pitcher in front of the three.
"Price is a silver penny each, Captain," he said with deceptive mildness.
Matt had heard the big man speak in the same tone, a heartbeat, before he thumped another horse handler over the head with a stool.
"Children is 5 coppers if they's more than waist high on me, and 3 if they's shorter, but only children as has to be carried gets in free."
The honey-skinned Shonchan raised a hand as if to push Bolin out of his way, then hesitated, his face growing harder, if that was possible. The other two squared up beside him, fists clenched as pounding boots announced the arrival of every man in the show, it seemed, performers in their flashy garb and horse handlers in coarse wool. Every man had a club of some sort in his hand, including Luca in a brilliant red coat embroidered with gold stars to his turned-down boot tops, and even the bare-chested Petra, who possessed the mildest nature of any man Matt had ever met. Petra's face was a thunderhead now, though. Like this had the makings of a massacre with these fellows' companions not 100 paces away and all their weapons to hand. It was a good place for Matt Cawthon to take himself out of. Surreptitiously, he touched the throwing knives hidden up his sleeves and shrugged just to feel the one hanging down behind the back of his neck. No way to check those under his coat or in his boots without being noticed, though. The dice seemed like continuous thunder. He began to plan how to get Tuon and the others away. He had to hang on to her a while longer yet. Before Disaster could open the door, another Shan-Chan appeared, in blue, green, and yellow striped armor, but carrying her helmet on her right hip. She had the tilted eyes and honey-colored skin, and there was a scattering of white in her close-cropped black hair. She was near a foot shorter than any of the other three, and there were no plumes on her helmet, just a small crest like a bronze arrowhead at the front. But the three soldiers stood up very straight when they saw her.
"Now why am I not surprised to find you here at what looks to be the fine beginnings of a riot, Murel?"
Her slurred accent had a twang in it.
"What's this all about, then?" "We paid our money, standard-bearer,"
the honey-skinned man replied in the same twangy accents.
"Then they said we had to pay more on account of us being soldiers of the Empire."
Bolin opened his mouth, but she silenced him with a raised hand. She had that kind of presence. Running her eyes over the men gathered in a thick semicircle with their clubs, and pausing a moment to shake her head over Luca, she settled on Matt.
"Did you see what happened?"
"I did," Matt replied. "And they tried to walk in without paying."
"That's good for you, Murel," she said, getting a surprised blink from the man. "Good for all three of you. Means you won't be out your coin, because you're all confined to camp for 10 days, and I doubt this show will be here that long. You're all docked 10 days' pay as well. You're supposed to be unloading wagons so the home folks don't get the idea we think we're better than they are. Or do you want a charge of causing dissension in the ranks?"
The three men paled visibly. Apparently that was a serious charge.
"I didn't think so. Now, get out of my sight and get to work before I make it a full month instead of a week."
"Yes, standard-bearer,"
they snapped out as one, then ran back across the road as hard as they could go while tugging off their coats. Hard men, yet the standard-bearer was harder. She was not finished, however. Luca stepped forward, bowing with a grand flourish, but she cut off whatever thanks he was about to offer.
"I don't much like fellows threatening my men with cudgels," she drawled, resting her free hand on her sword hilt. "Not even Murel. Not at these odds. Still, shows you have backbone. Any of you fine fellows want a life of glory and adventure? Step across the road with me and I'll sign you up. You there in that fancy red coat, you have the look of a born lancer to me. I'll wager I can whip you into a proper hero in no time."
A ripple of head-shaking ran through the assembled men, and some, seeing that no trouble was likely now, began slipping away. Petra was one of those. Luca looked as though he had been pole-axed. A number of others appeared almost as stunned by the offer. Performing paid better than soldiering, and you avoided the risk of people sticking swords into you.
"Well, as long as you're standing here, maybe I can convince you. Not likely you'll get rich, but the pay is usually on time, and there's always the chance of loot if the order is given. Happens now and then. The food varies, but it's usually hot, and there's usually enough to fill your belly. The days are long, but that just means you're tired enough to get a good night's sleep. When you don't have to work the night, too. Anyone interested yet?"
Luca gave himself a shake.
"Thank you, Captain, but no," he said,
sounding half-strangled. Some fools thought soldiers were flattered by someone thinking they had a higher rank than they did. Some fool soldiers were.
"Excuse me, if you please. We have a show to put on, and people who aren't going to be pleased if they have to wait much longer to see it."
With a last wary look at the woman, as if he feared she might try to drag him off by his collar, he rounded on the men behind him.
"All of you! Get back to your stands. What are you doing lounging around here? I have everything well in hand. Get back to your stands before people start demanding their money back."
That would have been a disaster in his book. Given the choice between handing back coin and having a riot, Luca would have been unable to decide which was worse. With the show folk dispersing and Luca hurrying away while shooting glances at her over his shoulder, the woman turned to Matt, the only man remaining aside from those two horse handlers.
"And what about you? From the look of you, you might be made an officer and get to give me orders."
She sounded amused by the notion. He knew what she was doing. The people in the line had seen three Shan-Chan soldiers sent running, and who could say for sure why they had run, but now they had seen her disperse a much larger crowd by herself. He would have given her a place in the band as a bannerman in a breath. "I'd make a terrible soldier, standard-bearer," he said, tipping his hat, and she laughed. As he turned away, he heard Bolin saying mildly, "You didn't hear what I told that man? It's a silver penny for you and another for your good wife." Coins clinked into the pitcher. "Thank you." Things were back to normal, and the dice were still racketing in his head. Making his way through the show, where acrobats were again tumbling for the crowds on their wooden platforms, and jugglers juggling, and Clarine's dogs running atop large wooden balls, and Miora's leopards standing on their hind legs inside a cage that looked barely strong enough to hold them, he decided to check on the Aes Sedai. The leopards brought them to mind. The common soldiers might spend the day working, yet he would have laid coin on at least some of the officers coming for a look before long. He trusted Tuon, strangely enough, and Aginan had enough sense to stay out of sight when there might be other Seanchan around. But common sense seemed in short supply among Aes Sedai. Even Teslin and Edesina, who had spent time as Damani, took foolish chances. Jolene, who had not, seemed to think herself invulnerable. Everybody in the show knew the three women were Aes Sedai now, but their large wagon, covered with rain-streaked whitewash, still stood near the canvas-topped storage wagons not far from the horse lines. Luca had been willing to rearrange his show for a high lady who gave him a warrant of protection, but not for Aes Sedai, who put him at risk with their presence and were practically penniless besides. The women among the show folk were sympathetic to the sisters for the most part, the men wary to one degree or another. It was almost always so with Aes Sedai. But Luca likely would have turned them out to make their own way without Matt's gold. Aes Sedai were more threat than anything else so long as they were in lands controlled by the Seanchan. Matt Cawthon got no thanks for it, not that he was looking for any. He would have settled for a touch of respect, unlikely as that was. Aes Sedai were Aes Sedai, after all. Jolene's warders, Blerick and Fenn, were nowhere to be seen, so there was no need to talk his way past them to get inside, but as he approached the dirt-streaked steps at the back of the wagon, the fox-head medallion hanging beneath his shirt went icy cold against his chest, then colder still. For a moment he froze like a statue. Those fool women were channeling in there. Coming to himself, he pounded up the steps and banged the door open. The women he expected to see were all present. Jolene, a green sister, slender and pretty and big-eyed, and Teslin, a narrow-shouldered red who looked as though she chewed rocks, and Edesina, a yellow, handsome, rather than pretty, with waves of black hair spilling to her waist. He had saved all three from the Seanchan, had gotten Teslin and Edesina out of the Damani kennels themselves, yet their gratitude was variable, to say the best. Bethamin, as dark as Tuon, but tall and nicely rounded, and yellow-haired Sita had been Suldam before they were forced into helping rescue the three Aes Sedai. The five of them shared this wagon, the Aes Sedai to keep an eye on the former Suldam to keep an eye on the Aes Sedai. None realized their task, but mutual distrust made them carry it out assiduously. The one woman he had not expected to see was Sitala Annan, who had kept the wandering woman in Ebu Dar before she decided to make herself part of that rescue for some reason. But then Sitala had a way of pushing herself in, of meddling, in fact. She meddled between him and Tuon incessantly. What they were doing was completely unexpected, though. In the middle of the wagon, Bethamin and Sita were standing rigid as fence posts, jammed shoulder to shoulder between the two beds that could not be raised against the walls, and Jolene was slapping Bethamin's face again and again, first with one hand, then the other. Silent tears trickled down the tall woman's cheeks, and Sita looked afraid that she would be next. Edesina and Teslin, arms folded beneath their breasts, were watching with no expression whatsoever, while Mistress Annan frowned her disapproval over Teslin's shoulder. Whether disapproval of the slapping or of what Bethamin had done to earn it, he could not have said and did not care. Crossing the floor in one stride, he seized Jolene's upraised arm and spun her around. "What in the light are you—" That was as far as he got before she used her other hand to catch him a buffet so hard that his ears rang. "Now that killed the goat," he said, and, spots still floating in his vision, he dropped down onto the nearest bed and pulled a surprised Jolene across his lap. His right hand landed on her bottom with a loud smack that pulled a startled squawk from her. The medallion went colder still, and Edesina gasped when nothing happened, but he tried to keep one eye on the other two sisters and one eye on the open door for Jolene's warders, while he held her in place and whacked as fast and as hard as he could. With no idea how many shifts or petticoats she was wearing under that worn blue wool, he wanted to make sure he left an impression. It seemed his hand was beating time for the dice spinning in his head. Struggling and kicking, Jolene began cursing like a wagon driver, as the medallion seemed to turn to ice, and then to grow so cold he wondered if it would give him frostbite. But he soon added wordless yelps to her pungent vocabulary. His arm might not match Petra's, but he was far from weak. Practice with bow and quarterstaff gave you strong arms. Edesina and Teslin seemed as frozen in place as the two wide-eyed former Suldam. Well, Bethamin was grinning, and she appeared as amazed as Sita. But just as he began to think Jolene's yelps were outnumbering her curses, Mistress Annan tried to push past the two Aes Sedai. Astonishingly, Teslin made a peremptory gesture for her to remain where she was. Very few women or men argued with an Aes Sedai's commands, but Mistress Annan gave the red sister a frosty look and squeezed between the two Aes Sedai, muttering something that made both of them eye her curiously. She still had to force her way between Bethamin and Sita, and he took advantage of that to land a final flurry of hard smacks, then rolled the green sister off his lap. His hand had begun to sting anyway. Jolene landed with a thump and let out a gasped, "Oh!" Planting herself in front of him, close enough that she interfered with Jolene's hasty scramble to her feet, Mistress Annan studied him with her arms folded beneath her breasts in a way that increased the generous cleavage displayed by her plunging neckline. Despite the dress, she was not Ebu Dare, not with those hazel eyes, but she had large golden hoops in her ears, a marriage knife, the hilt marked with red and white stones for her sons and daughters, dangling from a wide silver collar around her neck, and a curved dagger thrust behind her belt. Her dark green skirts were sewn up on the left side to show red petticoats. With touches of gray in her hair, she was every inch the stately Ebu Dare innkeeper, sure of herself and accustomed to giving orders. He expected her to upbraid him. She was as good as an Aes Sedai when it came to upbraiding. So he was surprised when she spoke, sounding very thoughtful.
"Jolene must have tried to stop you, and Teslin and Edesina as well. But whatever they did failed. I think that means you possess a Tirangreal that can disrupt flows of the power. I've heard of such things. Cadswain Maladrin supposedly had one, or so rumor said. But I've never seen the like. I would very much like to. I won't try to take it away from you, but I would appreciate seeing it."
"How do you know Cadswain?" Jolene demanded, attempting to brush off the seat of her skirt.
The first brush of her hand brought a wince, and she gave over with a glare for Matt just to show him she still had him in mind. Tears glistened in her big brown eyes and on her cheeks. But if he had to pay for them, it was worth the price.
"She said something about the test for the shawl," Edesina said. "She did say, 'How could you have passed the test for the shawl if you freeze at moments like this?'" Teslin added.
Mistress Annan's mouth tightened for a moment, but if she was discomposed, she regained her poise in a breath.
"You may recall that I owned an inn," she said dryly. "Many people visited the Wandering Woman, and many of them talked. Perhaps more than they should have."
"No Aes Sedai would,"
Jolene began, then turned hurriedly. Blerick and Fenn were starting up the steps. Borderlanders both, they were big men, and Matt quickly got to his feet, ready to use his knives if necessary. They might drub him, but not without bleeding for it. Surprisingly, Jolene darted to the door and shut it tight in Fenn's face, then fastened the latch. The Saldaean made no effort to open the door, but Matt had no doubt the pair of them would be waiting when he left. When she turned around, her eyes were blazing hot, tears and all, and she seemed to have forgotten Mistress Annan for the moment.
"If you ever even think of—"
she began, shaking a finger at him. He stepped forward and stuck a finger of his own to her nose so fast that she jumped back and bumped into the door, from which she rebounded with a squeak, spots of red blooming in her cheeks. He cared not a whisker whether that was anger or embarrassment. She opened her mouth, but he refused to let her get a word in edgewise.
"Except for me, you'd be wearing a demonic collar around your neck, and so would Edesina and Teslin," he said,
as much heat in his voice as there was in her eyes.
"In return, you all try to bully me." You go your own way and endanger all of us. You bloody well channeled when you know there are Shonchan right across the road. They could have a Damani with them, or a dozen for all you know.
He doubted there was even one, but doubt was not certainty, and in any case, he was not about to share his doubts with her, not now. Well, I might have to put up with some of that, though you'd better know I'm getting close to my edge. But I won't put up with you hitting me. You do that again, and I vow I'll pepper your hide twice as hard and twice as hot. My word on it.
And I won't try to stop him next time if you do, Mistress Onan said.
Nor I,
Teslin added, echoed after a long moment by Edesina. Jolene looked as though she had been hit between the eyes with a hammer. Very satisfactory. As long as he could figure out how to avoid having his bones broken by Blerick and Fenn.
Now, would someone like to tell me why you bloody decided to start channeling like it was the last battle? Do you have to keep holding them like that, Edesina?
He nodded at Sita and Bethamin. It was only an educated guess, but Edesina's eyes widened for a moment as if she thought his Tirangrial let him see flows of the power as well as stop them. In any case, an instant later, both women were standing normally. Bethamin calmly began drying her tears with a white linen handkerchief. Sita sat down on the nearest bed, hugging herself and shivering. She looked more shaken than Bethamin. None of the Aes Sedai seemed to want to answer, so Mistress Annan did it for them.
There was an argument. Jolene wanted to go see these Shonchan for herself, and she wouldn't be argued out of it. Bethamin decided to discipline her, just as if she had no clue what would happen.
The innkeeper shook her head in disgust.
She tried to pull Jolene across her lap, with Sita helping her, and Edesina wrapped them up in flows of air.
I'm assuming,
she said, when the Aes Sedai all looked at her sharply.
I may not be able to channel, but I do use my eyes.
That doesn't account for what I felt, Matt said. There was a lot of channeling going on in here.
Mistress Annan and the three Aes Sedai studied him speculatively, long stares that seemed to probe for the medallion. They were not going to forget about his Tirangrial, that was for sure. Jolene took up the story.
Bethamin channeled. I've never before seen the weave she used, but for a few moments, until she lost the source, she had sparks dancing all over the three of us. I think she may have used as much of the power as she could draw.
Sobs suddenly racked Bethamin. She sagged halfway to falling to the floor.
I didn't mean to,
she wept, shoulders shaking, face contorted.
I thought you were going to kill me, but I didn't mean to. I didn't.
Sita began rocking back and forth, staring at her friend in horror. Or perhaps her former friend. They both knew Adam could hold them, and maybe any Suldam, but they might well have denied the full import. Any woman who could use an Adam could learn to channel. Likely they had tried as hard as they could to deny that hard fact, to forget it. Actually channeling altered everything, however. Burn him, this was all he needed on top of everything else.
What are you going to do about it?
Only an Aes Sedai could handle this.
Now she's started, she can't just stop, I know that much.
Let her die, Teslin said harshly. We can keep her shielded until we can be rid of her. Then she can die.
We can't do that,
Edesina said, sounding almost shocked, though not apparently at the thought of Bethamin dying.
Once we let her go, she'll be a danger to everyone around her. I won't do it again,
Bethamin wept, almost pleading.
I won't.
Pushing past Matt as if he were a coat rack, Jolene confronted Bethamin, staring up at the taller woman with her fists on her hips.
You won't stop. You can't, once you begin. Oh, you may be able to go months between attempts to channel, but you will try again and again, and every time your danger will increase.
With a sigh, she lowered her hands.
You are much too old for the novice book, but there's nothing for it. We will have to teach you. Enough to make you safe, at least.
Teach her,
Teslin screeched, planting her fists on her hips.
I do say let her die. Do you have any idea how these Suldam did treat me when they did have me prisoner?
No, since you've never gone into detail beyond moaning over how horrible it was, Jolene replied dryly, then added in very firm tones, but I will not leave any woman to die when I can stop it. That did not end things, of course. When a woman wanted to argue, she could keep it going if she was by herself, and they all wanted to argue. Edesina joined in on Jolene's side, and so did Mistress Hanan, just as if she had as much right to speak as the Aes Sedai. Of all things, Bethamon and Sita took Teslin's part, denying any wish to learn to channel, waving their hands and arguing as loudly as anyone. Wisely, Matt took the opportunity to slip out of the wagon and pull the door shut behind him softly. No need to remind them of him. The Aes Sedai, at least, would remember soon enough. At least he could stop worrying about where the bloody Aedom were, and whether the Suldam would try using them again. That was well and truly finished now. He had been right about Blerick and Fenn. They were waiting at the foot of the steps, and storm clouds were not in it for their faces. Without any doubt, they knew exactly what had happened to Jolene. But not who was to blame, it turned out.
"What went on in there, Cawthon?" Blerick demanded, his blue eyes sharp enough to poke holes.
Slightly the taller of the two, he had shaved his Shinaran topknot and was not best pleased by the growth of short hair covering his scalp.
"Were you involved?" Fenn asked coldly.
"How could I have been?" Matt replied, trotting down the steps as if he had not a care in the world. "She's an Aes Sedai, in case you hadn't noticed. If you want to know what happened, I suggest you ask her."
"I'm not wool-headed enough to talk about it, I'll tell you that.
Only I wouldn't ask her right now. They're all still arguing in there. I took the chance to slip out while my hide was still intact."
Not the best choice of words, perhaps. The two warders' faces grew darker still, impossible as that seemed. But they let him go on his way without having to resort to his knives. There was that. Neither seemed very eager to enter the wagon, either. Instead, they settled on the wagon's steps to wait. More fools, they. He doubted Jolene would be very forthcoming with them, but she might well take out some of her temper on them, because they knew. Had he been them, he would have found tasks to keep him clear of that wagon for, say a month or two. That might help. Some. Women had long memories for some things. He was going to need to watch over his shoulder for Jolene himself from now on. But it had still been worth it. With Shaun Chan camped across the road, and Aes Sedai arguing, and women channeling as if they had never heard of the Shaun Chan, and the dice spinning in his head, not even winning two games of stones from Tuon that night could make him feel anything but wary. He went to sleep, on the floor, since it was Doman's turn to use the second bed. Eginen always got the other. With the dice bouncing off the insides of his skull, but he was sure that tomorrow had to be better than today. Well, he had never claimed to always be right. He just wished he was not quite so wrong so often.